That grinning, glowing, globular invader of your living room is an inhabitant of the pumpkin patch, and if your doorbell rings and nobody's there, that was no Martian. It's Halloween.
The Columbia Broadcasting System and affiliated stations present Orson Welles and the Mercury Theater on the air in The War of the Worlds by H.G. Wells.
I had every hope that that the people would be excited as they would be at a melodrama.
The cylindrical object, which lies in a pit directly below our position, surrounded on all sides by 8 battalions of infantry, without heavy field pieces, but adequately armed with rifles and machine guns. All cause for alarm, if such cause ever existed, is now entirely unjustified.
Listeners must have had tremendous faith in the power of radio in 1938. They were already quite confident radio would bring them important news bulletins when major events were happening. But some must have been terribly susceptible to listening without critical thought. War of the Worlds, performed live on radio 80 years ago, is obviously fiction. But a majority of listeners who tuned in late, about 15 minutes late if historical records are accurate, thought it was really happening. Even if they tuned in late, they missed at least 10 obvious signs this is just a story. It's radio drama. I'm Paul Cross. This is Cross Talk, commentary and analysis. When the Mercury Theater production of War of the Worlds came on the air over CBS radio stations at 8 o'clock in the evening, Sunday, October 30th, 1938, it likely reached about 4 million Americans. By about 8:20, the number of listeners had grown, likely to somewhere between 6 million and 9 million. The population of the U.S. at the time, 129 million. In Toronto, War of the Worlds was broadcast on CFRB, a CBS affiliate. It's not clear how many Canadians were hearing the show. According to Hadley Cantrill at the Princeton Radio Project, the Office for Radio Research, 63% of listeners who tuned in late thought an attack by Martians was really happening. His investigation, flawed in some respects, concludes perhaps 1.2 million people in the United States felt some fear. He uses the term excited next to the figure of 1.2 million on page 58 of his formal report in book form, The Invasion from Mars. When he writes in summary about those feeling panic, he uses the term thousands. Certainly, had listeners heard the very beginning of the broadcast the way it was intended to be heard, it would have been very clear the show is fiction.
Ladies and gentlemen, the director of the Mercury Theater and star of these broadcasts, Orson Welles.
We know now that in the early years of the 20th century, this world was being watched closely by intelligences greater than man's.
The War of the Worlds was the best known of the many novels written by H.G. Wells. Still, it was 39 years old when the Mercury Theater adapted it for radio. And there are many clues connecting the radio story to the flow of the novel, and many obvious signs this is just a story. For listeners in Toronto, hearing the show on CFRB, there's a glaring fiction about 9.5 minutes in as another clue that this is not real.
Ladies and gentlemen, here is the latest bulletin from the Intercontinental Radio News, Toronto, Canada. Professor Morse of Macmillan University reports observing a total of 3 explosions on the planet Mars between the hours of 7:45 p.m. and 9:20 p.m. Eastern Standard Time.
Of course, there was and is no such place as Macmillan University in Toronto. And at the time the actor says between 7:45 and 9:20 p.m., it's only 8:10 p.m. in Toronto. And I imagine radio listeners would wonder, what is this intercontinental radio news agency they're talking about? Never heard of that before. It, too, does not exist. The Mount Jennings Observatory in Chicago, referred to in the story, does not exist. How about universal clues the show is not reality? An announcer says, for the past 10 minutes, we've been interviewing Professor Pearson after only 2 minutes. 2 minutes after that, we're told the professor and the reporter have just traveled 11 miles in 10 minutes. But what about all the other signs the show is fictionalized drama for American listeners who tune in late? In a previous episode, we examined the idea that at about 8:15, many listeners tune into CBS, switching away from a movie star singing on a show on NBC. Even tuning in at 8:15, when the sounds of or lead up to the battle might have been heard by someone tuning late, when the spacecraft opens, there's a sound from an organ around 18 minutes in. By 19 minutes, an announcer is talking about a professor giving a dinner speech in California and talking about explosions on Mars. It's too early in the day for a dinner speech in California, and the professor has that information way too soon to be able to talk about it in a dinner speech. By this point, to the early listener, the voice of Professor Pearson has not been heard for 4 minutes. But when he returns right after the bit about the speech in California, some miles from where he'd last been seen, Pearson is obviously the voice of Orson Welles.
The next voice you hear will be that of Professor Pearson, brought to you by direct wire. Professor Pearson.
Of the creatures in the rocket cylinder at Grover's Mill, I can give you no authoritative information, either as to their nature, their origin, or their purposes here on Earth.
Next, the radio reporter, Carl Phillips, played by Frank Reddick, has not been heard from since the battle scene crescendo at 8:18. But 4 minutes later, we are told his body has been identified at a hospital in another town miles away. At 8:25, the story has 7,000 soldiers somehow amassed and moving in on the spaceship, yet less than 45 seconds later, we're told the battle is over, the force wiped out, with only 120 known survivors from among the 7,000. Nevertheless, an intrepid radio reporter character claims the radio company has somehow, enterprisingly, run wires into the mountains to continue to broadcast the story. Radio's not just powerful, it must somehow be magic, I suppose. And this, by just past 8:30, an Air Force bomber is preparing to attack the Martians. The listener is somehow traveling inside the plane with the crew. Listen to this. The voice of the crew sounds like it is on some kind of two-way radio device, but the sounds of the aircraft engines? Those sound as if we are hearing them from inside the aircraft in real-life sound.
Army bombing plane V-843 off Bayonne, New Jersey. Lieutenant Volt commanding 8 bombers, reporting to Commander Fairfax Langham Field. This is Volt reporting to Commander Fairfax Langham Field. Enemy tripod machines now in sight. Reinforced by 3 machines from the Morristown cylinder. 6 altogether. 1 machine partially crippled. Believed hit by shell from Army gun in Wachung Mountains. Guns now appear silent. A heavy black fog hanging close to the earth of extreme density, nature unknown. No sign of heat ray.
It's remarkable to think that after this moment, listeners could believe that the radio already knew there were 3 million people on the move evacuating New York City. And then, at 8:39, the only station break for station identification and a commercial in the entire show, the second planned announcement that this is a radio drama.
You are listening to a CBS presentation of Orson Welles and the Mercury Theater on the Air in an original dramatization of The War of the Worlds by H.G. Wells. The performance will continue after a brief intermission. This is the Columbia Broadcasting System.
There's a similar announcement on the way back into the program following a commercial. There had been no other stop for station identification or commercial so far, because at this point, the Mercury Theater on the air had not yet found a sponsor. The next 20 minutes are unmistakably fiction. The character, played by Orson Welles, wonders if perhaps he is the only surviving human, eventually meets another, eventually learns of how the Martians meet their end, unable to survive earthly bacteria, and watches humanity reemerge. If listeners were frightened, why did they not try to find out whether what was happening on the radio was really happening? In the case study by Cantrill, a third of those surveyed did nothing to find out. In a study by CBS itself, nearly half say they did nothing. But those who did, by tuning to another radio station to hear whether there was news, or by phoning the radio station carrying the show, or by phoning the police or a newspaper, or by looking in the radio listings in the newspaper for that day, quickly and absolutely realized they were listening to fantasy. Yes, some listeners were so frightened they left their homes and started to try to escape. To where? Many were not sure. There was more of this in New Jersey and New York, where the story sounded as if it was taking place. But even the somewhat flawed study, The Invasion of Mars, a study in the psychology of panic, while recognizing conditions that could lead to mass hysteria, puts a low number on those who actually panicked. Hadley Cantrill figures 28% of those listening thought it was real. He puts that number at about 1.7 million. 1.2 million, he says, were excited, that term from page 58. In his introduction to the piece in 1940, and again in a follow-up in 1966, Hadley Cantrill suggests that during the War of the Worlds radio broadcast, thousands of people panicked. Many of those did nothing to try to figure out what they were actually listening to.
Tonight, the Columbia Broadcasting System and its affiliated stations coast to coast has brought you The War of the Worlds by H.G. Wells, the 17th in its weekly series of dramatic broadcasts featuring Orson Welles and the Mercury Theater on the air. Next week, we present a dramatization of three famous short stories. This is the Columbia Broadcasting System.
Listeners should have a healthy skepticism about what they hear, says Cantrill. Education will be central to that. In 1940, Hadley Cantrill is seeing the need for what we call today media literacy, a need no less, and still poorly met, I maintain. This is Cross Talk. I'm Paul Cross. I study and I teach radio.